Good evening. Happy Valentine's Day. I'm surprised to see you all here. What's that about? I thought it was just going to be me and Richard tonight. It would have been great. I took a little Valentine's hike today with a few friends up at Wilder Ranch. And listened to the Dharma of the Insentients there. One of my friends knew of this meadow towards the Empire Grade end of Wilder Ranch, not the coastal end, but the mountain end, that's about 3 or 4 acres, and it's just strewn with daffodils that are in full bloom. So none of us had been there, but we had to search around for a little bit, but it was beautiful. Of course, we all experienced this beautiful day, and the daffodils were in full bloom. And between the five of us, we got most of that that Wordsworth poem about the daffodils. And of course, because I was listening to the Insentients, that poem became kind of a Dharma poem, as all things can be. I plucked out the Dharma parts of it. We might get a sugar rush if I read all five verses of it, but so I just plucked out the Dharma parts of the poem. I wandered lonely as a cloud that floats on high o'er dale or vales and hills, when all at once I saw a crowd, a host of golden daffodils. Behind the lake, beneath the trees, fluttering and dancing in the breeze. That's the famous first verse. I gazed and gazed, but little thought what wealth the show to me had brought. And then the last verse, for oft when on my couch I lie in vacant or in pensive mood, they flash upon my inward eye, which is the bliss of solitude. So I think that's what we do in our practice, is cultivate that inward eye. And I don't know whether the inward eye is the bliss of solitude, or whether solitude is nothing but bliss, and within that solitude is cultivated the inward eye. But they flash upon my inward eye, which is the bliss of solitude. I've got an idea about these are some of my thoughts about what Kathy talked about last week in her talk on the Dharma of Insentience. I don't think I was cultivating the inward eye on my walk today. It was a great walk. And but we were kind of jabbering and talking the whole 3 hours, enjoying each other's company in the beautiful outdoors. And so we were certainly nurtured and refreshed. But I think it was a very different walk that when Kathy talked about, you know, going out in nature to transform her consciousness. And what was the term you used, that to hear the insentience, you needed the keen awareness without attachment? Was that the phrase?
Consciousness. A subtle consciousness and awareness without attachment.
Yeah. So, along with Kathy, who is, you know, really going out there to hear the Dharma, were lots of people just like me, kind of running on the beach and enjoying. Kathy was talking about a beautiful sunset, and there were certainly other people hiking and biking in Wilder Park today, Wilder Ranch. But I wasn't really listening to the insentience. I spoke, I think, about my walk this summer. My long hike this summer was a real practice. I think I really cultivated, at the beginning of the walk, cultivated that keen awareness without attachment, so that my walk became a practice. But I think it's different. It's like doing yoga at the gym, you know, is a great experience, and you loosen up your body, and it gives you lots of benefits. But then there's a yoga teacher who is, you know, teaching yoga as a way of realizing your true nature, and I think it's a different experience. And it's the same with our zazen. I know a lot of people get sent to Santa Cruz Zen Center by their therapists to lighten up. To relax, to just be still and quiet for a little bit, and you know that is just fine, and hopefully, the practice grows from there. But that's how I'm looking listening to the Dharma of insentient beings these days is first with the mind and body of zazen, whether I'm walking or whether I'm sitting cross-legged. So if we would have had another couple of minutes at the end of Kathy's talk, I would have talked about that. But I'm glad that in our kind of goofing around trying to remember this poem among the group of us, that somebody remembered that last line they flash upon the inward eye within the bliss of solitude, which is the bliss of solitude. It kind of brought me back to my Dharma heart and mind. Zen seems to nudge us towards the inconceivable. Maybe we start off with just being still and lowering our blood pressure a little bit. But if we stick around a little bit and come to a few classes or a few talks, or just if we experience the bliss of solitude again and again, maybe we get a little glimpse of the inconceivable and start hearing the Dharma preached all around us again and again. So it's something that's cultivated over time. We might hear at some point when we start about the precepts, and they might seem like a good idea to not kill and not tell lies and not brag about yourself. And we might, even if we start practicing those precepts, our relationships might be going a little bit better for us if we're really practicing with the precepts. And we might get some sort of an idea, a concept about interconnectedness. When I practice these precepts, I feel a little more connected. I'm certainly getting along with people a little better. And so I think that's, another pathway towards, towards the inconceivable Buddha nature, the inconceivable liberation where all things save themselves. So I think those precepts, we can really start with practicing something pretty concrete and conceptualized, and it kind of starts opening us up. We're not so fixed by ourselves, and maybe we're experiencing a little more interconnectedness. So I think that's another way that Zen starts pointing us towards the inconceivable liberation and the saving of all beings. Maybe when we feel that we're not holding on so tightly to ourselves practicing the precepts, or bowing to each other when we, get onto our cushion, for instance, or when we pass each other outside, maybe that kind of loosens up our attachment to the self a little bit. And we start looking at that idea that gets thrown around of dropping the self, dropping body and mind. Catherine used to talk about a key practice is really recognizing when your self arises. When a strong opinion arises, to be able to say, yep, there's Patrick again. He has that opinion so strongly, or or, you know, when an idea about how somebody else should do something, like drive or cook your food, or when one of those strong thoughts comes up, it's a good practice to say, yep, there he is again. So we get to really know when that self arises. And then when we start practicing the precepts, we see, oh, I'm holding on a little less tightly to this self. I seem to be getting along a little better. My world seems to be a little bigger. We might get the idea that maybe that's in the direction of dropping body and mind. And as we sit here day after day, period after period, in the bliss of solitude, maybe sometimes we actually do realize no self, or dropping our picking and choosing, dropping our opinions. Maybe we kind of, you know, let this skin of an ego just fall away for a little bit here and there, within the bliss of our solitude. When we think no one is looking, we feel brave enough or fearless enough to drop body and mind, ego, for a little bit here and there. And I think then we realize for those brief moments that true self, or Buddha nature, or emptiness, without this ego covering, and I think we feel some sort of resonance. We experience some sort of resonance, or we realize some kind of, you know, deep resonance. And I've talked about this with other language before, but I think that resonance keeps us coming back. That really becomes the kind of positive reinforcement that brings us back to the Zendo time and time again, despite maybe the early hours of the morning, or despite the discomfort in our knees for these 40 minutes. I think we really resonate with those moments of dropping body and mind, and that true self that's not just right here in this spot, but this true self that Suzuki called a big mind, that's really as vast as the universe. We have other practice, I think, in experiencing excuse me, the inconceivable, and it's good to bring up on Valentine's Day, is I think love, which we think of maybe as a human characteristic, but I don't know. I don't know about that. But I think love is pretty inconceivable. I think we know it when we see it. We know it when we're in it. We say we're in love. But I think, you know, just as there's a whole, you know, bookshelf of books in our library, they're trying to talk about the, you know, what is the inconceivable ultimate truth. I think there's a lot written about, you know, what love is. There's many ways of looking at it, and it can't be described as just one thing. I mean, where does it live? I don't think we think of love as just being right here, that, you know, it just sort of was given to me, you know, when I've met this person. And it lives right here, and hopefully it lives in my beloved as well, and that love is just directed, you know, with this pair. Maybe that's how we see it a lot, but I don't think that's what I've experienced. I don't think it really lives any place in particular. I think it sort of is something that gets cultivated, that was always there, and gets revealed. And it gets revealed when we drop a little of our, you know, hard ego shell, and finally can experience a little intimacy in our lives. So it's, I think the inconceivability of love and the inconceivable true nature have those things in common. I don't think it is something in the brain. You know, we've never heard of like somebody having a stroke and then completely recovering and not having any speech problems or not having any walking problems, but they look at their husband and say, "Gee, I'm all better now, and tell me again what our relationship is." You know, so I don't think there's a place in the brain where love lives. I think it's really, you know, like big mind. It's vast. When I think of, you know, my little family in San Luis Obispo, growing up on Sycamore Drive, the interrelatedness of my family that was tinged with affection more often than not, and maybe I can call that where I learned about love. It probably wasn't any different than the love in the family next door, you know. So there was something that wasn't just mine. It was vast. It spread all up and down the street. So I think we shouldn't be afraid of these lectures on hearing the insentients speak the Dharma with our inconceivable awareness. Because I think we all have a pretty good idea of what love is and its inconceivability. I don't think it's so different. Thinking back to Sunday school in Mount Carmel Lutheran Church. I think we did a whole unit in Sunday school on God is love. And I think that was, maybe that's a line in the Bible, or maybe it's some, you know, Norwegian pastor's idea of trying to teach the non-dual experience of God, that we all have, that we were all within, you know, the love of a family I think you know, Buddhism isn't, you know, doesn't have the copyright to talking about the non-dual awareness of our source, of our true self, of our true being. So I think all of our practices, whether mundane or super mundane here in the Zen Center, are pointing us to this dropping body and mind and cultivating, realizing our true self. And I think after a while, we just sort of get it. We just sort of let go a few times. An insight that I had on my big hike this summer was going beyond means relaxing even more. Means letting go a little bit more. Can I relax even more on this cushion? Can I relax even more walking in Wilder Park? Can I let go of these thoughts or obscurations that are clouding the full blossom of my true nature, of Buddha nature, and that's how I like to think of it these days. Rather than working harder to find a special state of mind, can I relax even more in the beautiful sun of the open meadow? Kathy and I both looked at this book when we wanted to talk about the inconceivable practice that we do. Kazan, 100 years after Dogen, one of our ancestors, talks about relaxing even more, but says it this way: our original nature is never given to another or received from another. It's not this thing that used to be over there that now I've got, or that someone gave me a good idea over there and I just kind of ran with it. Our original, so it's not apart from us. Our original nature is never given to another or received from another. It should be like touching your own nostrils by searching your face. It's as clear as the nose on your face, for God's sakes. And it's a little deeper. It's not quite skin deep. You have to go into your nose. You have to look a little deeper. You have to be willing to do something a little bit different than you usually do. But it's pretty close. It's not something that needs to be cultivated with any kind of special. Maybe you should cross your legs every once in a while. Maybe you should sit solid in a while. But it's pretty darn close. As close as the nose on your face. I liked that. And there it was. Spoken in, 1320 or something. It's as clear as the nose on your face. our true nature. Kathy looked for inspiration in the Tozan section, you know, maybe ancestor 22 or 23. But Kazan kind of finds this true nature right in the very first case. Shakyamuni Buddha. He saw the morning star and was enlightened, and he said, "I and the great earth and beings simultaneously achieve the way." I want to give full credit to Kokyo. It was just a week or so ago that he talked about, Shakyamuni Buddha, received transmission from that morning star. There was a Shakyamuni Buddha, none other, from receiving the Dharma from the Insentients, our very first transmission story. He saw that morning star and was enlightened and said, "I and the great earth and beings simultaneously achieve the way." And Kazan goes on to discuss this. "From now on, you must not see any Shakyamuni Buddha apart from the great earth and all beings." Isn't that a great line? From now on, this book, these glasses, Richard and Lisa, are just Shakyamuni Buddha. Shakyamuni Buddha is not apart from any being and from anything on earth. "Even though mountains, rivers, and their myriad forms flourish in great abundance, none are left out of the very pupil of Gautama Buddha's eye. All of you here," meaning at 115 School Street, "are also established in the pupil of Gautama's eye. Not only are you established in it, but rather it is enfolded within you." He's even winding us up even deeper in it. "Also, the pupil of Gautama's eye becomes the fleshly body. It becomes the whole body of each person, standing like an 80,000-foot precipice in each of us. Therefore, do not think that from the past to the present, there was an eye's bright pupil over here and distinct people over here. Don't think that. You are the pupil of the Buddha's eye. Gautama is the entirety of each of you." Wow. How do we practice with that? Or how do we realize that? It probably wouldn't resonate so much with you those first few times that you were here, kind of just lowering your blood pressure or just trying to get the posture straight. I mean, maybe for some people it started having some juice to it, some real energy. But probably, I'll speak more personally. When I started having those kind of glimpses on the cushion of no picking and choosing, saying to myself, you know, I could just sit here all day. Or those times that I'm sort of surprised by the bell ringing, that it's a jolt. It's for that bell to ring. Those glimpses of really embodying big mind or the whole universe, those glimpses, probably then I start dealing with, it says Shakyamuni Buddha is my entire body. Gotama's eye is my entire body. Then I could start working with that. I would want to visit that. I would really want to kind of gain confidence or trust or faith in that, because I'd experienced this glimpse of it in my sitting, and I'd want to come back and really try to cultivate that Gotama's eye is my entire body. And I could do that in the morning when I came here at 5:45, or maybe generate keen awareness without attachment on a hike at Wilder Park, and really realize Gotama's eyeball as the entire body of the universe. I might start working with it that way. And I might just keep it as an idea, as, you know, maybe if that is the non-conceptual practice of Shakyamuni's enlightenment, maybe the more conventional practice is, can I hold that close by? Can I remember it when I'm not getting along with somebody so well? Can something stop me and say, you know, he's Gotama's entire eyeball. Gotama's eyeball is the entirety of him. And maybe, and maybe that will kind of loosen me up a little bit. Maybe I can drop some of those opinions and ideas about how that person should act or react to me. That kind of tight snake skin of an ego might just start loosening up a little bit if I can hold that concept, which is related to Shakyamuni's awakening. If I can just hold that idea, maybe it'll help me loosen the grasp I have on this separate self and bring me closer, even in more difficult times. I think that's how we work with these inconceivable practices and realizations, both on the cushion and when we you know, bow out the door here and get in our cars and are practicing in the marketplace. So maybe there's a few thoughts on the inconceivable concept of love that we've thought about today all day long. Maybe it's come up, or maybe I know a lot of us have been thinking about Kathy's talk this week and hearing the preaching and teaching of the Incensians. Maybe something has come up as that's kind of been stewing all along. I was walking to the Zen Center down Mission Street. I just before this sitting tonight, and there's a big hedge along the way, and there was a big candy box all open for just anybody to take candy. And so love is in the air and on the bushes. Were you going to say something, Yarrow? Did I see your hand flicker? And you know, I don't think I had these insights, you know, in the 50s and 60s in San Luis Obispo, but it was you know, this the God is love part. Even then, I don't think I was thinking it's, you know, the love I feel for my parents or for my grandparents. That it was this sort of attitude, as you were implying, of acceptance and.
Compassion.
That could be cultivated. So it wasn't a love with an object. It was an attitude. I was going to say way of being, but it was being. Thank you, Nettie. Again?
How do you preach to us as an sentient being out on School Street?
I don't know if I still understand your question. My first idea is that I would always be preaching as a sentient being. That's sort of my nature. I certainly think that we've talked about this in concepts of, you know, just walking down the walkway to get to the door here, kind of through the garden and crossing the gates. We start to cultivate that keen awareness without attachment, so that I think the preaching of the Dharma starts from the insentience of just the years of sitting here and the landscaping and So those are the first things that come to mind when I hear your question. Am I on the right track?
Yeah. So is that you preaching to us? Or can we see the depth of you? Is that you?
I think it's Buddha nature. I think it's from now on, we don't see Shakyamuni separate from the walkway, the sangha, the shrubbery. I think we start cultivating Buddha's awakening, maybe from the gate, maybe from when we get in the car to come to the Zen Center. Who knows when we start loosening our ego skin and hearing the Dharma that's around us all the time. Mary.
For some unknown reason, what comes to my mind is the book where, in Berkeley in 1960, if you meet the Buddha on the road, Killen. And I think it's been a long time since I read it, but I think it meant to me now that that's not where you're going to find him. If he's out there and you meet him, that's not really him. Is that sort of like it's not there, it's all those other things you're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, one way of looking at that line is when you've got a good idea that's the enlightenment that I want, or that's enlightenment there, or that person is enlightened, and when it starts becoming this idea, that's when you should sort of say, well, let me get a little looser about that. Let me let the strictness of that idea kind of spread out a little bit. And I think that's what you were saying, is whenever you get this idea that's it, that should be the mindfulness bell to say, well, let me stay open. Let me connect with all possibilities. Kathy.
Well, I'm really appreciating you bringing up our kind of a similar metaphors. But the and love. Because one of the things I don't like about Valentine's Day is all the commodification and the pressure for different people about, you know, if you love, you know, you got to get the flowers, you got to get the hearts, you got to go out to dinner, you got to, you know, if you don't do that, you're in the doghouse, all that kind of stuff. And I just think that to think about or to consider love in the same way that we would try to consider the inconceivable Dharma is really helpful. Mm-hmm. It's very liberating because then immediately we realize, oh, we don't know. It is not a commodity.
It is
not a thing. It is not something you can buy, and it's not something that you even can really understand.
Mm-hmm.
So that is, to me, a very opening kind of koan that I will take up contemplating.
Yeah.
And thank you for making that, you know, offering that as a kind of similar thing to look at.
Well, thank you. And it's all those things, and it's also something that we all know. You know, so it's our nostrils. It's the nose on our face. Despite its inconceivability, it's it's pretty close to us as well. So it meets all that criteria.
Yeah, it's both. I mean, you're right. It is close. It isn't inconceivable in the way that we can't experience it. Mm-hmm. But to think that we know what it is, to
right.
pin it down.
Or draw a line. Yeah.
Right.
Right.
That's the one I'm feeling intrigued to open and relax about.
Yeah. Thank you. Kokyo.
Do you feel it's important that Keizan said it's like looking for and finding your nostrils as opposed to your nose?
I like the idea of going a little deeper. I couldn't let that one slide. I couldn't let that one go.
I also appreciate that when you get really close to a nostril, there's nothing but empty space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's undeniable.
Yeah, but in the same vein of, you know, there's no difference between our, you know, skin, bones, and marrow, I think he could have just as well have said, you know, it's no farther away than just your nose. I think that's also saying the same thing. But it doesn't have that great opportunity for a. For a great visual. Edie.
So in my daily walks, there are always dogs walking with their best friend. And some dogs smile, I swear. Does anybody here know that there's a woman dog smiles? So what is that about?
Moo.
I think that's love.
I agree.
Love.
good observation, Lotus Moon. One last one. How nice.
Yeah.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah. A Valentine.
Yeah. Thank you. May the merit of our practice this evening open our hearts to the love that Shakyamuni showed us with his big heart and big mind. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to become it.